This podcast is supported by Washington.org. Washington, D.C. offers visitors so much to explore. Just ask Dayo, who shared her experiences from a recent visit.
What was your favorite food all weekend?
The Ethiopian food at Sihei.
And the first place you would visit again?
The bookstore, Little District Books.
What did you appreciate the most?
Really just like the genuine kindness of everyone that I encountered this weekend.
Why should people visit D.C.?
Well, D.C. is a place with such a thriving culture.
Washington, D.C. has something for everybody. Plan your next trip at Washington.org.
Was one family responsible for America's opioid crisis? Patrick Radden Keefe will join us to discuss his new book, Empire of Pain. What makes a novel like a choose-your-own-adventure for adults? Liz Egan will be here to discuss her latest pick for group text, the novel What Comes After. Plus, we'll talk about what we and the wider world are reading. This is the Book Review Podcast from the New York Times. It's April 23rd. I'm Pamela Paul. Patrick Radden Keefe joins us now. His new book is called Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. Patrick, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me back.
So let's start with a very basic question in case people are not aware of the Sackler family and why you would be writing about them with a title like Empire of Pain. Who are the Sacklers?
So there's sort of two ways to answer that question. Until a few years ago, what the Sackler name meant generally, to the extent that people were aware of this family, it was a very, very wealthy family, one of the wealthiest families in the United States, with a branch in the UK, in London. And they were known chiefly for philanthropy.
Right. Art museum wings.
Hundreds of millions of dollars to art museums and universities and medical research, and would very often put their name on these bequests. So if you, you know, in New York City, you go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and there's the Sackler wing. And that was what they were known for. What was more mysterious was the source of this wealth. And it has, people have become more widely aware recently that that the bulk of this wealth comes from a company, Purdue Pharma, which produces the powerful painkiller OxyContin.
In this era in which the naming of things and the unnaming of things, the mounting and the unmounting has become very active, is it still the Sackler wing in the Metropolitan Museum? Is Sackler still emblazoned on all of these buildings and donated wings?
Well, it's very much in flux. So as you and I speak today, it's still the Sackler wing, but the Met has actually announced that they said they weren't taking any future donations from the Sacklers because of the connection between the family and the opioid crisis. And then more recently, they've said that they are, assessing is the word, whether or not the Sackler wing will remain the Sackler wing. Some institutions have started to take the name down. So Tufts University took down the Sackler name from a series of buildings because the students there, this was at the medical school, had said, I don't want to go to class in a building named after this family and get my medical education there. More recently, New York University has done the same. The Louvre in Paris has taken down the Sackler name. So I think there's a real question for many of these other institutions, and there's dozens and dozens of them, where the name still stands of whether or not they'll keep it.
All right, let's find out why people want to take that name down. You start your book with Arthur, the paterfamilias of the clan. Who was he and how did he make his money? And how did he differ from what some members of the family called the Oxy Sacklers?
Yeah, Arthur Sackler was a kind of incredible protean, very New York character. He was born in Brooklyn in 1913, and he grew up the oldest of three brothers in a family of immigrants who had come from Europe. And he became a doctor. He had grown up during the Great Depression, and he was sort of forged by that experience. And he had this amazing energy. So he became a doctor and encouraged his younger brothers, Mortimer and Raymond, to become physicians as well, which they did. But Arthur was also a businessman. And so he started companies left and right. He got into medical advertising in addition to practicing medicine and ended up running his own wildly successful medical advertising company and made a huge fortune as the person who designed the marketing for Valium.
What was the Valium tagline? How was it sold?
Well, so this was what they called a minor tranquilizer. And the idea was that there were major tranquilizers on the market at the time, which were really for people who were psychotic, for people who had pretty severe conditions that required a very strong response. Minor tranquilizers, the idea was, look, anybody who feels a little anxiety, a little social nervousness or depression could take a minor tranquilizer. And in the case of Valium, what that entailed was overplaying the therapeutic benefits, the number of conditions that it could be useful for, underplaying the risks. So, for instance, the risk that Valium could potentially be addictive, which it turned out to be. And then really appealing not just to consumers, but to doctors. This was what Arthur Sackler really excelled at. He was a doctor himself, but in medical advertising. And so his pitch was to the prescriber. He realized that that was where the riches lay. If you could convince physicians to write prescriptions, that was how you developed a juggernaut. And sure enough, Valium became, at the time, the most successful drug in the history of the pharmaceutical industry.
You have to then wonder, doctors are not idiots. They'd seen this. They knew this history. How did this work for OxyContin? Why wasn't there more skepticism? What was in it for doctors?
I mean, I should say, just for the sake of clarity, that Arthur, who I very deliberately chose to focus the first third of the book on Arthur, but Arthur dies in 1987. And it's only later in the 1990s that two other branches of the family, which own this company, Purdue, unveil OxyContin, this powerful painkiller, but with a similar playbook to what was used with Valium. You know, this question of how easily swayed physicians are was one that I really fixated on in this whole process. I don't know about you. I think people differ. Like even my wife and I are different about this. But if I go see my doctor and my doctor tells me, if I say I've got these symptoms, my doctor says, okay, you have X, you need to take Y. I will just sort of blindly follow his advice because I figure he must know. My wife will second guess any doctor, no matter how expert, with a little Googling of her own. But I'll just take it on faith. And Arthur Sackler, in particular, had a notion that doctors are kind of unimpeachable, that they couldn't be swayed by something like advertising. He actually would say, you know, it's not really advertising I do, it's just education. But as I dug into this, I found that there's a lot of evidence that doctors can be swayed. You know, Purdue Pharma, this company that still sells OxyContin, one amazing figure I came across as I was researching the book is there was a period of time when they were spending $9 million a year just to buy food for doctors. And if you talk to physicians, and I have, they'll say, oh, I would never be swayed by, you know, somebody buying me a meal. Like that couldn't change the way I prescribe. But you have to figure that at the company, they're not going to spend that $9 million if they're not really closely looking at the numbers and realizing that actually it does change the behavior of the doctors.
All right, let's get back to the two other brothers and Purdue Pharma, because as you pointed out, OxyContin doesn't come to market until 1996. What was the company doing before then, and how did they end up developing OxyContin?
It was originally called Purdue Frederick, this family business, and Arthur Sackler bought it in 1952. He basically bought it for his brothers, and so the three of them owned it, but it was really his younger brothers, Mortimer and Raymond, who were always following in his wake, who ran the company. And for years and years, it had a kind of steady business in very unglamorous staples. An antiseptic solution that was very successful. They had earwax remover, various not particularly groundbreaking products, over-the-counter products that they sold, and they did a tidy business. In the 1980s, they started becoming more innovative as a pharmaceutical company, and they marketed a new drug called MS Contin, which was a painkiller, a morphine-based painkiller that had a quite innovative coating on the pill, which would allow for a dose of morphine that would slowly filter into the bloodstream over a period of hours. And eventually that was very successful, and the patent on that was coming up. And it was at that point that they thought, well, how could we use that coating and find another drug that we could use with it? And that was where they came up with the idea of using oxycodone, an opioid painkiller. And that gave birth to OxyContin, this drug that now we're all familiar with.
What was so special about OxyContin? What made it so successful?
So it was really all about the coating, the seal on the pills. There's only one active ingredient, it's oxycodone. And that drug had been around for decades, nearly a century. And what happened, though, was in the past, you know, if you've ever been prescribed Percodan or Percocet, there are prescription painkillers in which you get oxycodone in quite small doses, and it's mixed with aspirin or acetaminophen, which means that you wouldn't take too much of it because those can be toxic if taken in large doses. So you'd have a small dose of oxycodone in something like Percodan or Percocet. the real novelty of OxyContin was you could have a huge dose of this drug oxycodone that with this, that what they called the Contin seal, it would regulate the flow of the drug into your bloodstream over 12 hours. This was the idea. So you get a kind of continuous, almost like a drip of the drug into your bloodstream. And what that meant in terms of the market was that people wouldn't need to take, they wouldn't need to wake up in the middle of the night to take painkillers in order to relieve their pain. They could sleep through the night because in theory, and it worked out to be more complicated in practice, but in theory, the drug lasted 12 hours. And so there was a big marketing campaign with OxyContin where they would say, you know, it just takes two doses, one in the AM and one in the PM, and you're set.
Okay, so this drug comes to market in 1996. Presumably, it's used primarily in hospitals and then for post-surgical pain, right? How does it become a big problem?
MS Contin, the predecessor drug, had really been a cancer drug. There was a sense that it was a kind of nuclear solution that a patient would graduate to. And it was morphine, and there was a sense that it would be administered when somebody was battling really severe cancer-related pain or was in an end-of-life care situation. The problem is that, you know, while that was a robust market and made hundreds of millions of dollars a year for the company, it's a limited market. And so what Purdue and the Sacklers set out to do was position OxyContin as a drug, not just for severe pain, but actually also for moderate pain. And that would be a much, much bigger market. I mean, they estimated, the company itself estimated that there were 40 to 50 million Americans who suffered from some form of chronic pain. And so if you could position this drug so that it would be a kind of an approachable alternative, not the thing that you go to as a last resort when you've tried everything else, but actually to use the tagline that they developed for OxyContin, they said, it's the one to start with and the one to stay with.
Oh, too true.
Well, exactly. And that was the intention. And I think in ways that probably even they didn't anticipate with the one to stay with part, you know, it turns out this drug was addictive. They hadn't done any studies in advance on addictiveness. And in fact, in their marketing, they rather cavalierly told physicians that it wasn't addictive, basically what they would say. And I've interviewed lots of former sales reps from Purdue who would go out and they would meet with doctors all day long. And they would say, you know, doctor, we've looked into this. There are studies. This is addictive less than 1% of the time.
So you just said, in part, probably they didn't even realize it in terms of the stay component. How culpable were they? I mean, at what point did they realize that this is having unanticipated consequences?
This is something I've thought about a lot and that I try and parse pretty carefully in the book, these questions of culpability. And You have to be pretty careful and nuanced, I think, in your discussion of this sort of thing, because the opioid crisis, which we end up with, which I would argue really springs from the launch of OxyContin, ends up killing nearly 500,000 Americans, right? It's this just absolute catastrophe from a public health point of view. So I do think that you need to be pretty scrupulous about who you assign blame to and in what measure. And you know, for me, looking very carefully at Purdue, but then also the Sackler family, which owned the company, which made billions and billions and billions of dollars from the sale of OxyContin, and which ran the company. You know, that the family now claims that they had only a kind of distant, you know, occasionally they got emails telling them what was happening at Purdue, but they really weren't weighing in a major way. I was able to, I think, establish a pretty elaborate paper trail proving that that's not the case, that in fact, many members of the family were fanatically micromanaging what happened in the business straight up until just a couple of years ago. So how do we assign blame? So for me, the really critical point is actually not the original launch of OxyContin or the fact that they didn't do tests for addictiveness or the fact that they designed this crazy marketing strategy and they thought that, you know, let's persuade doctors that these drugs aren't addictive, even though they didn't know that. And they aimed to make a drug for everyone to start with and to stay with. All of that, I think, is hugely problematic and does end up birthing the opioid crisis that we know today. Morally, though, for me, the really critical moment is after the drug is released, pretty quickly thereafter, there start being these indications that it's not what the family and the company have cracked it up to be. That, in fact, people are abusing it. They are growing addicted. They're overdosing. And they're dying. And word starts coming back to the senior leadership at the company that this is happening. And I feel as though at that point, that's when it really matters, right? Like that's the moment where they could have said, not we're going to pull the drug from the shelves, but they could have said, whoa, maybe we should slow down our marketing just a touch. You know, maybe we should be a little less assured about telling doctors this isn't addictive. Maybe we should do a little soul searching here and think about the magnitude of suffering that we're hearing about and just kind of take a hard look at how we're handling this. And that didn't happen. What happened was instead, both the business and the family kind of got into this defensive crouch. And they said, you know, the drug is flawless. There is no problem with the drug. The drug is not addictive. The problem is drug abusers, that there are people out there who just, you know, if they weren't abusing OxyContin, they'd be abusing something else. And they're you know, morally degenerate. And we share no responsibility for that.
And when was that in time? The drug comes to market in 1996. When did they begin to realize the implications and respond in that way?
The story that Purdue and the Sacklers have always told is that they didn't get an indication of any major problems until early 2000. So 4 years later.
Right. This is like echoes of the tobacco industry.
Yes. Yes, exactly. And so it's this question of, you know, what did they know and when did they know it? And what they have always claimed, including, I should say, in congressional testimony, in sworn depositions, they've always said, oh, we didn't really get it in a sense that there was any major issue at all until the spring of 2000. And then we learned about it from media reports. They learned about it from, they claimed, by reading the newspaper. One thing I was able to establish very definitively in the book is that, in fact, there is this paper trail really starting in 1997, so just a year after the drug is released, of sales reps sending messages back saying, hey, we've got a problem here. You know, people are abusing this drug. This is not working out the way we, you know, we've got an image problem with this drug out there on the street and indeed in the medical community. And there's very high level discussion by senior executives at the company, some of whom subsequently testified under oath that they didn't know anything about this until early 2000. In terms of the timeline, it's very hard to reconcile what they have always said publicly and what I was able to substantiate with internal documents.
And you also spoke to those salespeople, as you mentioned earlier. I mean, what did they say? How do they realize they're going out there, they're meeting with doctors, presumably they're selling these drugs. How do they realize there's a problem?
One thing I found talking to the sales reps, and I think this is true of executives at the company and probably true of the Sacklers as well, is there was actually a fair amount of idealism. It might have been naive idealism, but in the early going with OxyContin, there was a sense that, you know, we're out here doing God's work. We're bringing relief to hundreds of thousands, millions of people who are suffering from terrible pain. So it becomes this question of how do you recalibrate your understanding of what you're doing as new evidence comes in? And for the sales reps, it was pretty immediate because they're out there meeting with doctors and doctors would say, God, you know, my patients are coming back and they're saying they need more and more. They were talking with pharmacists who were concerned about some of the people who were getting prescriptions. I had this amazing conversation with one sales rep who told me that the way he discovered there was a problem is he'd been on the job for a while. I think this is in 1999. So again, before the company claims they ever knew anything. And he had this one doctor who was a big prescriber. And for the sales reps, they loved the doctors who prescribed a lot of OxyContin. They actually had a name for them. They called them whales, the way people in Vegas refer to big gamblers, because it was very profitable to have a doctor like that. And he went to call on the doctor and he found her just looking really downcast and asked what had happened. And she said that she had a relative who had just died and that she had overdosed on OxyContin. So literally the way this guy learns that there's a problem is that the doctor who he's been visiting, who's been prescribing so much OxyContin, loses a family member to an overdose.
We talked a little bit earlier about the division within the family between Arthur's heirs and the so-called OxySacklers, his two brothers and their family members. Is there any other dissension in the family? Are there any internal whistleblowers, anyone who would talk to you for this book?
This is one of the big riddles for me is I was convinced that there must be. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out, is there some apostate?
Right. Some angry nephew.
Absolutely. Someone who feels any measure of discomfort about the source of the family wealth. And it's funny because there are a lot of particularly younger Sacklers. I mean, I describe in the book Madeline Sackler, who's a filmmaker who makes kind of social justice type films. there are members of the family who don't work for the company, never have worked for the company. And some of them quite righteously say, why should I have to answer questions about this business? Who would suggest that I am in any way complicit when I didn't make any of these business decisions? And I kind of balk at that a little bit. I mean, I would never suggest that the level of complicity is the same, but these are people who are very, very wealthy because of the sale of OxyContin. You know, they all have these trusts which accumulate money coming from the sale of this drug. And there is not a single person who has shown any daylight between them and their family, any level of discomfort, to a point where one thing I obtained as I was researching the book was a private WhatsApp log of a family chat among the heirs of Mortimer Sackler that lasted over a year of back and forth. And, you know, a lot of it was planning dinners and wishing each other Merry Christmas. But then some of it was talking about the PR problems for the family. And all of these younger Sacklers who didn't work for the business, but who have been hugely enriched by it, they talked about this as a PR problem. It was incredible to see that even in private, on this line that's just family members, there's nobody who says, hey, God, maybe we should take a beat and think about this. Maybe we do have some responsibility.
I'm taking it they are not pleased about the publication of this book. What was it like trying to get some kind of comment from them during the process of your research?
It wasn't pleasant. I mean, I knew from the outset that they would not. I had written this piece in The New Yorker in 2017 about the family. And as soon as it was announced that I was doing the book, I started getting legal threats. The Mortimer Sackler branch was actually less antagonistic, but the Raymond Sackler branch of the family really kind of, you know, came after me with a whole string of legal threats, suggestions that they might sue. I live outside New York City in the suburbs. There was a point that I describe in the book where there was a private investigator staking out my house. I should say, I don't know that the Sacklers sent the investigator, but it would be hard for me to imagine who else would. And when I asked the family whether they knew anything about this, they refused to comment. The challenge for me as a writer is if you're going to tell a story like this without direct access to the people you're writing about, can you do it in a way that feels vivid and authentic and intimate enough that the reader doesn't feel like they're seeing these people through a telescope? And the way I managed to do that was through gathering a lot of documents, through doing a lot of interviews and talking to people who know the family, but also through gathering a huge amount of private correspondence. So even though I didn't have the opportunity to interview these people in person, the book is still very largely told through their own words.
Where do things stand now with Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family? We talked a little bit about their name coming off of things, but where are they legally and financially?
As of now, there are about 2,500 lawsuits against Purdue Pharma. Almost every state in the union is suing the company over its role in the opioid crisis. Roughly half the states are actually suing the Sacklers individually. And you end up in this kind of crazy situation in which, over a period of about a decade, the family started really aggressively pulling money out of Purdue. So they would get these huge disbursements, you know, a few hundred million here, a few hundred million there. And over about a decade, they took $10 billion out of the company and, you know, put the money in private accounts offshore and their private trusts and so forth. And then what happened is that you get this huge storm of litigation, all these lawsuits. And at that point, the family says, all right, well, we're just going to put the company in bankruptcy because the company doesn't have any money anymore to deal with all these lawsuits. So you end up in this strange state of affairs where Purdue Pharma is now in bankruptcy, in a bankruptcy court in White Plains, New York. The Sacklers have not declared bankruptcy because they've taken all the money out of the company. And the big legal question now is what kind of accountability they may or may not face. Will these lawsuits by the states be allowed to move forward? Or will the family do what I think they want to do, which is wrap this whole thing up in bankruptcy court? They would make a contribution. They've proposed a contribution of, I think, $4.25 billion.
Mm-hmm. And they have like what? They've made like $18 billion off this? Or
yeah, I mean, nobody even really knows. We know for sure, and it's been documented, and they don't deny that they took that in, I think it's 8 years, they took more than $10 billion out of the company. So if you think about it that way, right, I mean, $4 billion is a lot of money on the one hand. On the other hand, the one other thing to add is that just this, at the end of last year, Purdue Pharma pled guilty to fraud, to felony charges for the second time. Actually, it had done so in 2007 as well. So you have a period of time when the company is committing fraud, it's since pled guilty, and the family is taking money out. And what they're saying is, we'll give you 40 cents on the dollar for what we took out.
So much about this story, I think, would sound very strange to people who don't live in this weird little country we live in with its odd practices, from the bankruptcy to the way in which the pharmaceutical industry is structured. But one big question I imagine people who don't live here would have to ask is, how did this drug get to market in the first place? Why is there so little regulation? Not to absolve the Sackler family or Purdue Pharma of responsibility, but you have to wonder, like, why was no one else paying attention to this?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I should say, I mean, I focused on the family for a number of reasons, in part because I felt as though their story had not been fully told, in part because, honestly, I think it's a great story. I mean, I've always been fascinated by family dynamics, and I love to read family sagas. And so that was the particular story that I wanted to tell. That is not to say by any stretch that there isn't plenty of blame that can be assigned elsewhere. And part of the story I wanted to tell was actually a structural one about the way in which in our system in the United States, money just pollutes everything. And so whether it's the Department of Justice, which kind of let the company off easy, or Congress, which I think has not until fairly recently engaged enough scrutiny in this way and is all too easily bought off by donations and influence peddling, or in this case, the FDA. You know, the role of the FDA, I think, is a real problem here. So what the Sacklers would say, even today, is, look, all we ever did was sell a drug that was approved by the FDA. What was wrong with that? And if you put a lot of stock in the FDA being good at doing its job, then that might be a persuasive answer. But in the case of OxyContin, there's a story I tell in the book about a guy named Curtis Wright, who was the chief examiner at FDA, responsible for approving not just the drug, but also the marketing language that could be used. So Curtis Wright approves the drug, and then he leaves the FDA. And within a year, he goes and takes a job at Purdue Pharma for $400,000 in compensation. You know, I FOIA'd the FDA to try and get all his communications and sort of piece this together. And they were not very responsive. So I sued, and I got a judge in New York to compel them to turn over thousands of pages of documents to me. But when it came to Curtis Wright's communications, they said, you know, it's the strangest thing. We don't have anything left. It must have all just gotten lost or been destroyed.
I'm going to translate one word for listeners. FOIA'd is Freedom of Information Acted, I guess, is how you would put it, to request documents. Okay, it's a very complicated story. I want to ask you one final question related to that complexity, but on a personal level. Your book, Say Nothing, came out in 2019. So your paperback was out last year. You also had this great podcast out last summer, which I think defined my early/mid-pandemic period, Winds of Change, where I would like stalk around the neighborhood listening to that series. And you were writing this book. Explain how that was done. And now that it's basically all over, what are you doing?
Oh, God. Yeah. I mean, to take the second part first, I just want to take a nap. I'm exhausted. It's been a long year. I mean, it's been a long year for all of us, right?
Right. There was also that pandemic.
There was the little matter of the pandemic. The truth is that 2020 was supposed to be, we can all tell some version of the story, right? There were a lot of things I was going to be doing in 2020. Say Nothing was going to be coming out in other countries, and I was going to do some interesting travel and so forth. Everything just got swept away. And so in terms of the writing of this book, I found that it was very helpful to have all of my plans canceled for a year and be forced to stay in my home.
It's like house arrest for writers.
I am somebody who, particularly when it comes to things like just getting a book written, I have like confinement fantasies sometimes. You know, I think like if somebody could just cancel all my plans and my social obligations, and you really can't do anything but sit in your room. And in this instance, it was one of those bizarre ways in which the awful things happening in the world were kind of helpful. So Yeah, but I am tired at this point. I think I'm going to take a break.
All right. Well, the very good result for readers and for listeners is that you have three different Patrick Radden Keefe things that you can consume. One is Say Nothing, and Patrick was on the podcast for that. The second is his excellent podcast, Winds of Change. And his new book, of course, is Empire of Pain, The Secret History of the Sackler Dynasty. Patrick, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Joining us now to help celebrate the 125th anniversary of the book review, Tina Jordan. Hey, Tina.
Hey, Pamela. So today I'm going to talk about bylines because, of course, today all of our reviews are signed. But in the beginning, only a few of them were, and then only when they were written by a well-known critic or scholar. In 1905, the editor of the Book Review noted that the annual holiday issue was remarkable for the large number of valuable contributions from writers of eminence in their respective fields. But this really was the exception because the unnamed pundits regularly took pot shots at authors and poets and dramatists, some of whom began writing directly to the paper's publisher, asking that he intercede on their behalf. And that was Adolf Ox. He was very firm and courteous in his replies. And he told people, I should be pleased to have notice taken of your book, but I do not interfere. In fact, I cannot do so without totally demoralizing our organization. But there was one review in particular that set people off, and it was a review of George Bernard Shaw's plays Pleasant and Unpleasant, a collection that was published in 1898. And in the unsigned review, I'm just going to read you a few choice lines from it. Here's a good one. He has not a touch of the poetical in his composition, and the critic and satirist who is not a bit of a poet cannot reasonably hope to win wide renown as a dramatist. But my favorite lines are these. Mr. Shaw's new book is one in which multitudes of readers would find intolerably dry. A smart bit of historical perversion is called The Man of Destiny. Its subject is a supposed incident in the life of Napoleon and does show that Shaw has the instinct of stagecraft and the knack of devising situations. If only he had a poet's gift, he might become a real dramatist. So, I kind of love this. Obviously, George Bernard Shaw was an incredibly important playwright of the era. But this really was the norm, that these reviews were not signed. And in fact, it wasn't until, I believe, the early 1940s that the rule was that every single review be signed.
Well, that was very common, right, in the era. I mean, for a long time, Time magazine articles weren't signed. Newsweek didn't, I don't think, had bylines. The Economist still doesn't have bylines.
Absolutely. Things were not signed. In the case of critics, though, I do feel like criticism began to be signed earlier than other things.
Well, let's hear about more of those bylines in the weeks to come. Tina, thank you so much.
Thank you, Pamela.
It's time for our April group text pick, and Elizabeth Egan is here to talk about it. Liz, thanks for being here.
Pamela, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here to talk about What Comes After by Joanne Tompkins.
All right, what kind of book is this?
This is an atmospheric thriller slash mystery slash garden variety, just really good book about a small town in the Pacific Northwest that is reeling from a tragedy. The title, What Comes After, is very apt because this is the story of what comes after a tragedy where two teenage boys have died. One has been murdered. One dies by suicide. And we follow a pregnant 16-year-old as she wanders out of the woods on the outskirts of town and arrives at the home of the father of one of the boys. And we see how the town accepts the girl and holds off on asking some pretty difficult questions about who she is and where she came from. And as they piece together who she is, we do also. Really, the vibe is watching the town and these two parents recover from this huge loss.
Okay, there's a lot in there, but I want to start with the wandering out of the woods thing, because I'm thinking to myself, as you say that, we need to make a list of all of the novels that start with someone wandering out of the woods, and then compare that with, I mean, how often does someone wander out of the woods in real life, right?
Never. Where I live in suburban New Jersey, the person who wanders out of the woods is somebody you want nothing to do with.
So, okay, that aside, suspending disbelief for a moment on that. But I guess it is a very effective thing in a book to have someone wander out of the woods. Sometimes it's a child who's been held captive for who knows how many years and no one knows who her parents are. And other times it's someone emerging after an attempted murder. And I don't know what it is. Well, I guess this person wanders out pregnant, right?
She does. And actually, it's worth noting, this is the second group text book in 1 year where we've had somebody wandering out of the woods. The other one was Dear Child by Romy Hausman.
Right. Which I read and talked about. So I'm sensing you have an affinity for this.
I do. In this case, actually, you do know a little bit, and I'm not giving anything away, but the girl, Evangeline, you do learn right from the get-go that she has been abandoned by her mother, who is a drug addict, and she's leaving this trailer that she's been living in with her mother. So it's not like she's a woodland creature. She's really down on her luck. And she has a connection to the boys who have died. And I won't go into what it is, but she knows that the father of one of the boys is living alone in this big house. And so she seeks him out and he opens his home to her. And there's this amazing theme in the book, which I didn't get into so much in my review of it, but this father who she takes up residence with, his name is Isaac, he's Quaker and he's really struggling with his faith in the wake of his only child's death. So we get this story of the community rebounding, the families rebounding, the story of Evangeline's pregnancy. And we also have this story of a man's search for faith, which is not necessarily my favorite storyline. But I knew very little about Quakerism, and I thought that Joanne Tompkins, this is her first novel, I thought she handled it with such a light and thoughtful touch. And that, to me, elevated this book into a different level of beauty, I would say.
The things we don't know at the beginning of this novel are, who is the father of the child that Evangeline is carrying? What happened to the two dead teenagers exactly, and why, and what her connection is to those characters. And those are the underlying mysteries in the book.
Yes. And I should say that because I always think I know everything when I start a mystery, I always think I've solved it. I thought, oh, I personally, Liz Egan, I know who the father of this baby is. And I'm just telling you right now, I really didn't. It's a true shock. So it's a real mystery. And it unfolds very slowly and gracefully and poetically with a lot of fog and views of the sound and pine trees. And I think I mentioned this in my review, or maybe I didn't. There are a lot of animals in this book. And unfortunately for us, Pamela, I don't think there are any cats, but I love when the family dog is a character. And in this case, there's one named Rufus who kind of got under my skin.
You mentioned earlier that this was a debut. What drew you in? Why did you choose it?
It's really fat. It's a long book. And I was looking for something that I could really lose myself in. Also, I am the mother of three teenagers, and I'm constantly looking for the book that makes me feel a little better about how little I know about what's running through my kids' heads at any given time. I'm aware that on some level that's developmentally appropriate, but this book reminded me that teenagers have a life separate from the adults around them. And even now, in the middle of the pandemic, they have secrets. They have their own adventures that I try to keep track of. But there was something about this book that felt kind of reassuring to me, as strange as that sounds, because it begins with this terrible tragedy, but is really actually a book about life.
And Tompkins presumably is effective at capturing that teenage mindset and voice.
I thought she was. I'm eager to hear from a teenager who's read this book, because I read it and I felt the teenage voices seemed very authentic. But if I've learned one thing in my years as the mother of teenagers, they have a whole different meter for detecting a word that I won't say on the podcast.
Nonsense, let's say.
Yes, yes, exactly.
So if you were running a book club on this right now, that would be what you would want to know from any teenage members who happen to wander in. But what else would you want to ask everyone over hors d'oeuvres?
Would you open your door to somebody who arrived on your front porch with no history in your life? Would you have the capacity to dig deep in your lowest moment and share yourself with somebody else the way the people in this book do? I thought that was an interesting question. And also, I think that the questions around the Quaker piece of it were really interesting. The way that Isaac, the father, relies on his religious community to help him through this.
In your group text column, you compared the book to two other novels, really different ones, and I'm curious why you chose them. And if you could describe each of them to listeners so that they know what those books are about. The first was Gabriel Tallent's My Absolute Darling, which came out a few years ago.
That one is about a girl who's living alone with her father, who is horribly abusive. And what connected it in my mind to what comes after was the sense of atmosphere and wilderness around their home. She's this almost feral kid who finds comfort in the land and is like a... It's been a while since I've read it, but I think that she like knows how to use a bow and arrow, and she travels barefoot miles at a time. And her self-sufficiency reminded me of Evangeline. And actually the opposite, where she's living in this home that's incredibly abusive and not conducive to little kid life. In What Comes After, I found the opposite. There's such a sense of warmth and peace in the home where Evangeline takes up residence. So I thought it was an interesting comparison.
All right. And the other book is Lionel Shriver's We Need to Talk About Kevin, which I think I'm the only one in my demographic who has not read that book.
You have got to remedy that situation. It's a story told from the perspective of a mother whose son has turned out to be a bad seed, and she has long suspected that he isn't normal. Of course, what is normal, but that he isn't well. And we hear his story from her perspective after pretty much the worst has happened.
That was very succinct, Liz. It's interesting because I always think of that book as, I think the shorthand at the time was, this is like the Dylan Klebold book. This is the post-Columbine, how could that happen? How does someone raise a child like this novel? I don't know if Shriver based it on either of the Columbine killers, but perhaps it's just that it landed at around that time. But for whatever reason, they're closely associated in my head.
I closely associated them until I read Sue Klebold's memoir. She's Dylan Klebold's mother, and I had a completely different perspective on her relationship with her son and what their home life was like when he was growing up after I read that book.
She was a guest on the podcast of that book, and it was a really powerful conversation.
I almost listed her memoir as recommended reading with What Comes After, but it's so real, it felt almost wrong to pair it with fiction. It felt too casual, but it's really a stunning book.
So the book is What Comes After by Joanne Tompkins. Give us one last, like, you want to read this if kind of idea.
You want to read this if you're grappling with the idea of why terrible things happen, which I think we all are right now. How do you pick up and walk forward into the world when you're feeling disillusioned and devastated? And yet, this is not a sad, it is a sad book, but it's a book where you see the light at the end of the tunnel.
Liz, you always make me want to read everything.
Oh, good. Pamela, I'm so glad to hear that. I think you'll like this one.
All right. Elizabeth Egan is an editor at The Book Review, and she writes our monthly group text column. Joining us now to talk about what we're reading, my colleagues John Williams and Lauren Christensen. Hey there.
Hey, everybody.
Hi, Pamela.
So, John, what have you been reading?
I have a little mini quest story to go with what I'm reading this week, which I always like because it's so easy to find everything nowadays. I've been looking for a while for this book by Jane Gardam called Caruso's Daughter. It's a novel. She's best known here, I think, for her book Old Filth, which I read a million years ago. And I think I read another book of hers half a million years ago. But two years ago, I talked on the podcast about this short book that was published in Britain called Robinson. It was by a publisher there who used a pen name to write it. And it's all about Robinson Crusoe. It's about 100 pages. It's part memoir, but it's really a cultural study of the novel's, you know, reflection of British culture and also this sort of remarkable number of books and other artistic works that have been inspired by it. And one of the things he mentioned was this Jane Gardam novel. And so I've been looking for it ever since. It's out of print here. I finally just ordered it from the UK. I couldn't even find it in used bookstores. So I felt it's like when it takes you so much work to get a book, you're like really into it. You think this better be good. And it is. It's fantastic. I'm about 10 pages away from the end of it. It's about a six-year-old girl named Polly Flint, who she's not orphaned quite yet when the book starts. Her father drops her off at her two aunts' house. The aunts live together on the northern coast of England in a fairly isolated place right on the water. And Polly's mother has just died. And 2 months after her father drops her off, he dies. This all happens very quickly, so I'm not spoiling anything. And the two aunts, one is bleak and one is gentle, as Polly describes them. They're religious. They don't like that Polly doesn't want to go to church. She has a kind of stubborn disbelief from a very young age. But also from a very young age, she loves the novel Robinson Crusoe to the point of obsession, really. I think when she's an adolescent, she says she's read it 23 times, and she goes on to keep reading it. And when she's in her early 30s, she translates it a couple of times. She writes what she calls a spiritual biography of the novel. And what's great is that there's that through line of this beloved book and the way she talks and thinks about it. But it's a fairly short novel. It's less than 300 pages, and it feels even a little bit shorter than that when you're holding it in your hands. And yet it has this great old-fashioned sweep where you get Polly's life from, well, the time she's six when she's dropped off at the house to toward the end of the book, she's in her 40s, I think. And it happens without you really realizing that that much time is passing. And she has these relationships with a couple of people she ends up meeting locally. It's a pretty sparsely populated place, but she falls in love with a couple of people. One of them goes off to fight in the war. World War I happens. World War II starts to loom into the horizon. You get this great sense of history and also of this very isolated life lived against its background. And she's a great character. It is written in the first person from her perspective, and I'm loving it. And actually, when I started to think about talking about it on the show today, I realized that, you know, I think I like it even more than I was feeling as I read it. I think it's going to stay with me for a long time.
Jane Gardam wrote children's books too. So it's kind of interesting that she starts this one off from the perspective of a child.
Yes, you could almost study this book in a much closer way to find out what she's doing with the fact that she's telling the story from the perspective of herself almost at every age, and it's very seamless. I'm not quite sure how she does it. Gardam's done a lot. I think she's in her 90s now, and she might still be writing. But I was going to ask the both of you, though, if you've ever read, because I actually haven't read Robinson Crusoe itself. After I read that book I mentioned, it talked about J.M. Kutsaya's novel Foe, which is also about Robinson Crusoe, which is great. And it mentioned a Muriel Spark novel that I have, but I haven't read yet. And it left me with sort of 12 to 15 books to read afterwards, but I've never read the foundational text. And I wonder if it's great or you were bored by it or.
I haven't read it either.
I read the Defoe and Foe, the Kutsaya, in a class that I took in college that was about the origins of the novel, because Robinson Crusoe is considered one of the first novels. Some people might argue that it was the first novel, but insofar as it was really about the interiority of a person. So I read it largely as one reads for class, not for pleasure, but thinking about that question. I think it's worth reading for historical reasons, if nothing else, you know, to just get that sense of how did people create those first novels? How did that evolve?
There's this great scene. I think Polly's on a train and she's talking to someone. She's always defending the novel against her aunt, thinks that it's, I don't know if she says boring, but she wonders why she's bothering with it. And I think there's a man who says, Defoe, you know, you're reading Defoe, you should read Dickens. He'll make you laugh. So there's like she's always trying to tell people that this is actually a great work and they should read it. Lauren, what are you reading these days?
I am reading the debut collection by Disha Filia, The Secret Lives of Church Ladies. It came out this past summer from West Virginia University Press. It's 9 stories. It's a slim collection. I think it's a paperback, all centering on the lives of Black women at various stages in their lives. And you know what unites them is they're really all just pushing against society's expectations of them, whether, you know, figuring out their own sexualities or growing up and just gaining new understandings as all of us can relate to of who their parents are, you know, their parents' flaws and how those have shaped who the daughters are themselves. It's just a really astounding collection. And the one story that I really can't get out of my head is called Peach Cobbler. It's narrated by the daughter of a single mom who, you know, she's just known for making this really incredibly rich and sweet dessert from scratch. You know, all the time she does it by intuition, which, you know, in the very limited baking experience I have, you really can't do. You know, she just kind of like feels out the proportions of the ingredients, but it's this magical dessert. And her daughter witnesses her making this all the time and she smells it and she's kind of like salivating for it, but the mother never lets her taste it because this cobbler is for Pastor Neely, who is a character who, you know, is the pastor in the town who is married with a family, and he just comes over to their house where this mother and daughter live to eat the entire pie himself. You know, he's so hungry for it. And it's this really like carnal enjoyment that he gets out of this pie. And the daughter watching him, it's a really interesting look at hunger and desire. But after he's finished with it, you know, he takes the mother back into the bedroom and they have this ongoing affair. And, you know, eventually the girl experiences male betrayal of her own. You know, she's an adolescent girl. She has this feeling of being, you know, used and then discarded, and she experiences that for herself. But beyond that great storytelling, there's just this really quiet, effortless power of the sentences that Filia writes. I want to read just a really short sequence. It's like 4 sentences that, I mean, I think I could still cry, but I'm on a podcast, so I won't.
No, you can cry on this podcast, Lauren.
Should I start crying?
You're welcome crying on this podcast.
So the backstory is that the daughter has learned or taught herself to make this pie herself. She's just figured it out and she's really proud of herself and it's this accomplishment and she imagines making it for Pastor Neely as well. She's just imagining this. So she writes, I imagined him tasting my cobbler and telling me it was better than my mother's, the best in the world. I also imagined serving him a piece with ground up glass baked into the crust and watching him crumple to the floor. More than that, I wanted my mother to know and be proud that I could make a good cobbler. Mostly, I just wanted my mother.
I feel like you posted one of these sentences on Instagram and it freaked me out.
I think I emailed Disha when I read that. I mean, I still find it so powerful. I feel like it encapsulates so much of just what it feels like to be like a young woman and the things that you want and yearn for and like maybe don't get. And, you know, I'm hardly the first person to love this book. It's really made a clean sweep of this year's awards. I think it was a finalist for the National Book Award. It won the Pen Faulkner and the Story Prize. I think it's up for a couple of other things, including maybe the LA Times Book Prize. I really can't say enough great things about it. So if anyone hasn't read it, go pick it up. It's a very slim collection.
It's been on my radar. Pamela, what are you reading?
Well, I feel like the theme this week is kids, because one thing picking up on the Dickens is one of my kids is reading Dickens right now. And something that really surprised me that he said, because he does find it really funny. He's reading David Copperfield, and he read aloud to me this really terrible letter that Mr. Micawber writes in the novel. And just for the bad writing of the Mr. Micawber, but in writing is even worse than the way that Mr. Micawber speaks. And he said to me, you know, I remember you always talking about this character when I was little. And I was like, what? You know, it's one of those moments where you realize, like, as a parent, you're just like, blah, blah, blah. You're not even listening to yourself talk. But apparently I knew I'd spoken of Uriah Heep, but I did not realize apparently I talked about Mr. Micawber. So it's this recognizable character to him. I'm going to pull a John Williams, which is what I think of when John would come into the podcast studio with like three novels in a pile. Just be like, I have read these three books while you have struggled through a chapter of yours. I'm going to talk about two books. The first is the book that I just finished, which was True Grit by Charles Portis. And it's just one of those things where, you know, I feel really irritated at myself. Like I just, no matter how many times people said, you have to read it, you have to read it. I'm like, no, I don't. I've seen the movie three times. I don't need to read it. I've done that. And I'm talking about the Coen Brothers movie. I haven't seen the John Wayne version. But of course, you do have to read that book. It's just a perfect novel. Have you both read it?
I love that book.
I bought it after the appreciation piece that we ran soon after he passed away. And I still haven't read it yet, but it's on the shelf.
All right. So, John, let's talk. And we won't reveal anything to you. Lauren, have you seen the film? Or the either film?
No.
Oh, no. So you're totally fresh.
Go ahead. It's all right.
No, we won't reveal much.
Cut Lauren's mic for a couple of minutes.
Yeah.
It was a long time ago that I read it. When I say a long time ago, it was probably...
He says in a smug and superior tone.
No. 12 or 13 years, probably. So the memory of the details isn't super close. But what I remember is how funny it was and also how perfect it is as an exercise in... a very, very overused word, which is voice.
Yes. Yes.
It's like the perfect pitch of capturing this character's voice throughout the book is really remarkable.
So for those who haven't read the book and haven't seen the movie, just in short, it is about a 14-year-old girl named Maddie, whose father is killed. This is in the 1870s in Arkansas. So very much kind of frontier Western novel, but told from this 14-year-old girl's perspective. And she wants to avenge his death by going after the killer. And she seeks to employ a federal marshal to help her with this task. And, you know, it's interesting that you say voice, because my one problem, and Lauren, here, I feel like I just need to say this in no uncertain terms. Read the book before you see the Coen Brothers film, because Haley Steinfeld in that film, to my mind, she is Maddie. She's never not going to be Maddie, and Maddie cannot exist without her. And Lauren, I envy you that you will find your own Maddie because you haven't seen the film. You will hear your own version before you then hear Haley's. And then after you've done both of these things, you will come back on the podcast, please, and discuss.
See, it's so interesting that you say that, because I love the Coen Brothers and I really like that movie and I saw it a couple of times. But because I had read the book first, I kind of felt like Haley wasn't Maddie. And I thought she was doing a good job, but I could never get over the fact that she didn't match the one in my head.
Wow. So each one really ruins the other.
Yes. Yes. In short. Okay. No, but I think, John, you did it the right way. And Lauren, you will too.
Yes, I will.
And that's all I have to say about
Understood.
That.
Understood.
But, you know, there are these things, there are these cadences to Maddie's voice, and it's so persuasive and it's so winning that I was working on a writing project of my own after, and I found myself wanting to write, you know, I'm not even going to say Charles Portis because I feel like he just spoke through her. Him. Yes. She writes because it's also supposedly an account that she's written, and he is writing in the style of these women's accounts of history. He's giving legitimacy to that perspective from the time. She writes in this voice that is so winning that you just want to take it on. You know, I don't know. I want to write and speak like Maddie from now on.
Oh, totally.
Like, I want to end things with an exclamation point very strategically.
She's a strong influence.
She is. All right. So the other book that I read, and Lauren, I know that you read this too, so I'm eager to hear what you think, is Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro. I don't know. Wow. Deep breath. I loved this book. I think that, Lauren, you and I are both super fans, which I feel like is an understatement of Remains of the Day, which is another novel where the book and the movie are truly incredible separately as works of art. But this book, which Radhika Jones came on the podcast to talk about maybe a month or so ago, again, from a very distinct voice, which is that of an artificial friend, which is a kind of AI creature who is developed at some point in the future to keep company for children. And I don't want to say much more than that, but Lauren, why don't you talk a little bit about what you thought of the book?
I mean, I just thought it was incredible, old-fashioned, straightforward storytelling. Of course, we are experiencing the world through the eyes of Clara, who is artificially created to have emotions that are adjacent to those of a true human, but so much more perfect than that. And I think it's a really incredible kind of like indictment of actual natural humanity that, you know, I just kept thinking like I could never be as selfless as Clara. I could never think as clearly or, you know, so the thing about Clara is that she's really gifted. She's not even the newest model of artificial friend, but she's just so gifted in her perception. And so I just think it's a wonderful premise for an author to set out for himself to tell the story of a real girl who is Clara's eventual companion, you know, through the eyes of someone who is just singularly, you know, adept at noticing things and perceiving human interactions and emotions.
If either of these things is true, would you say that his intent seems to be to inspire us to be better or satirically to show us how bad we are?
Oh, I don't think at all it's to show us how bad we are. I don't think that the humans are portrayed unsympathetically. It's very realistic and relatable. It's almost a parable. The world is quite small that he draws. It's very relatable. These characters go through falling in love and growing up and growing pains and all those kinds of things that are very universal. It's certainly not pessimistic in any way. It's definitely inspiring. And it just, as Pamela said, it's just a meditation on loneliness. Clara is designed to keep company and why we need that. It's a really interesting question of why, you know, loneliness is something that needs to be addressed. And it's a really great way of coming at the loneliness that we're all feeling. Have been feeling, but in a universal way that we've always been lonely. It's beautiful, beautiful storytelling.
I guess the parallel with True Grit really is voice, and the challenge that I think Ishiguro set for himself, or maybe one of the challenges, is how do you create the interiority, the perspective of someone who isn't human? And works of science fiction have done that before, but I don't think that he's interested in that less from the point of view of technology and more from the point of view of humanity. And he uses this deceptively simple language to articulate the way in which Clara thinks. And that to me also is mastery in itself and restraint. He doesn't show off in any way. He sticks to the rules that he sets out for himself. So Clara never has these overly complicated thoughts or expressions because she's not capable. And so to kind of define for yourself, meaning for Ishiguro, these are the rules, this is the world of this creature that I'm setting out for myself. This is what she can and is, you know, is and is not capable of seeing. And then to abide by those and to have that run throughout and yet also have character development, I think it's just such an interesting challenge and achievement because he pulls it off.
You've both given me something to read this week, and I resent that.
Well, you know, that's usually the thing that you do that's highly irritating. We're all here to annoy one another. All right, Lauren, John, let's run down the titles again. What did you read?
I read Caruso's Daughter by Jane Gardam.
I read The Secret Lives of Church Ladies by Disha Filia.
And I read True Grit by Charles Portis and Clara and the Sun by Kazuo Ishiguro. Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. And you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. I write back, not right away, but I do. The Book Review Podcast is produced by the great Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media, with a major assist from my colleague John Williams. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.